You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gabriel Byrne was last on the show to discuss his starring role as the psychotherapist Paul Weston on In Treatment, the HBO series for which he won not only an Emmy, but also a Golden Globe Award. This time he's here in a very different capacity as Ireland's cultural ambassador, its first ever. And if that weren't enough, he's also the curator of a two-week film series at the Museum of Modern Art that explores Ireland on film. It's called Revisiting the Quiet Man, and it starts today, and I'm delighted that it has brought Gabriel Byrne back to our show. Hi.
It's great to be back, Lena. Thank you.
So how do you go about choosing which films would be good to explore how Irish identity is dealt with in the cinema? There have to be hundreds, maybe even thousands.
Yes. There was a huge selection of films to view. And I suppose you have to start off with a central question. And for me, that question was, who are we and how have we been presented on the screen? In other words, Irish identity in modern film.
From Ireland and from the United States?
Just from Ireland. Unfortunately, you see, the thing about it is that we didn't have an indigenous film industry. And every film industry, I think, has to compete with the American distribution system. So small Irish films were made now and again, but we did not have a way of telling our own story through film, which is something that I think American audiences take for granted, that most movies are about American themes and about American characters and so forth. So what happened was you occasionally had great directors who would come in and set films in Ireland, one of which was John Ford, who made The Quiet Man there. John Ford himself was the son of an Irish emigrant, and spoke Gaelic. And then later on in 1970, you had David Lean, who came in to do Ryan's Daughter.
A British director,
who had a view of the world that was, I would say, he thought of the world in colonial terms. And so his view of Ireland in that film was particularly questionable.
Well, he did Lawrence of Arabia, did Bridge on the River Kwai, and these were all about people being in other people's countries.
Yes, and Passage to India. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that people also had problems with Passage to India, where you had Alec Guinness, put on brown makeup to play an Indian actor. And
Well, they could have had Ben Kingsley do it.
Ben Kingsley, I think, is Indian. And was a great Gandhi in Richard Attenborough's film. But we had nobody to tell our own story. And if you don't get the chance to tell your own story, you are relegated to the position that's given to you by the person who has the power. In this case, it was Hollywood.
Well, it's interesting that you weren't telling your own story, because the Irish have told their own stories in theater. There's a great theatrical tradition,
sure.
Of course, in literature,
sure.
Some of the greatest writers of the 20th century. So you would have thought that one way or another, people would have been able to do that. And yet that was totally. So was the theater really just taking the place of cinema for the Irish people?
Well, I think that it's interesting when you look back over the Irish tradition. We've never produced, for example, a great painter, a great sculptor. We have produced great novelists, great poets, great playwrights. It's arguable that in the 20th century, that this was less than 100 years after Ireland began to speak English as its first language, our country had produced Yeats, Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw,
James Joyce,
Sean O'Casey, men who redefined world literature, not just English and Anglo-Irish literature. But before that, you had a tremendously rich Gaelic civilization that stretched back thousands of years, and that began to be written down in the 5th century by the monks. But the essential drama, I suppose, or the way we expressed ourselves dramatically, was in terms of storytelling. storytelling was free. It was you didn't have to train for it. It was able to allude to the past, the present, and the future. And it has always surprised me that for a country that thinks so much in terms of story and image, that we never really produced a great filmmaker up until perhaps the 80s with the arrival of Jim Sheridan and Neil Jordan. But John Ford was a Hollywood director, and David Lean was also a Hollywood director. So the images that went out of our country to the world, the reason we're starting with The Quiet Man is because, as you know, it's a controversial film because a lot of people think that it propagates the notion of Irish stereotypes and that it's somewhat derogatory. But actually, it's a much deeper and much wiser film than that. And Ford was a much greater filmmaker than just a maker of stereotypes.
Well, it's an American falls in love with Ireland. And yes, there are stereotypes there, but there are stereotypes in almost every culture. Still, you think of some of the other Ford films about Ireland, The Informer, which we have troubled Irish people, people who tell on their brothers. There are a lot of alcoholics in His Irish People in America. Pretty much every Union soldier, played by Victor McLaughlin, was an Irish alcoholic. So yes. this would suggest that he had certain difficulties dealing with his own sense of Irish American identity.
Well, that's a very interesting question because I think that the identity of the exile is a conflicted one. It's a fragmented one. All of Ford's films, I think, and a great deal of the literature of exile is about yearning, about longing for what's been left behind, what's gone. He was a romantic, and in The Quiet Man, a very passionate romantic. He was also perhaps somewhat naive in the way he saw politics, but his perspective as a filmmaker was certainly overlaid with this notion of yearning and longing and being split between two homes. And that's not something that's unique to Irish people. I think that anybody who's ever left the place that they belong to, that they come from, and go somewhere else, will always suffer that sense of fractured identity.
Well, you hold both Irish and U.S. citizenship now. You're raising your children here. How do you think of yourself, as Irish first or as Irish American?
Well, I don't hold American citizenship.
Oh, I thought you did.
I am what's known as a resident alien. It's a peculiar description. I always think that I should have like a pair of television aerials sticking out of my head on that photograph, but it really is a peculiar description. But I've lived here since 1988. Irish always, spiritually, in every way, I'm Irish. I see myself as an Irishman who lives in New York. Yes, I understand also that conflict between not belonging to the place that you come to, even though it feeds you on so many levels, and the inability, the impossibility of return and of being able to go back. And if you speak to people, America is made up of immigrants and the sons and daughters of immigrants, and if you speak to them about what home means to them, it's always an interesting answer.
But in the case of the Irish, they had a difficult time establishing a cultural identity here. They were discriminated against in the 19th century, and many were denied entry into this country. And then when Ford was making The Informer, which won 4 Academy Awards, there was still strong anti-Irish sentiment in the United States. You're the new cultural ambassador. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's still a need to fight against those old stereotypes today?
I think there's a need to fight against stereotypes of all kinds. I mean, we were just talking there about before we went on air about the absurd and barbaric laws against homosexuality that existed in England in the 1950s right up to the 60s. it's a natural propensity, I think, to put a label on somebody and say, oh, all French people are like that, and all Americans are like this, and all Irish people are like that. And film, because a story takes place over an hour and a half, it tends to chop off the complex bits and reinforce the bits that everybody can identify with. But I think stereotyping other people, as opposed to looking beneath the stereotype and trying to find the common humanity that we all have, is the reason, the real reason why I chose this film to open the film, is because the film festival, is because I want people to look at how we in mainstream American film treat our ethnic brothers and sisters in film.
On June 1st, you'll be showing a number of films by Sidney Alcott, the lad from Old Ireland, and Come Back to Erin, from 1910 and 1914.
Yes.
Silence, I assume.
Yes.
He went to Ireland to film them, the first American director to do that?
Yes, it's hard to believe that when you look at that footage, that in those beautiful prints that they have restored at the Irish Film Institute, it's just so beautiful to watch the stories that they were telling and the vitality they were telling them with, because they felt the need to. This was 6 years before the Irish Revolution in 1916, and 8 years. 10 years before the Russian Revolution, and 4 years before the First World War. And there was a sense that being Irish was... you had scientists, for example, who in the 19th century, learned scientists who gave lectures about the inferiority of certain races. The Irish, they would draw these heads of the Aborigine, the black man, and the Irish man's head, and they would show from cranial kind of reconstruction how the heads of these people indicated that they were actually inferior species, which was actually one of the driving forces of colonialism and the desire to get out there and tell your own story and your own history. I spoke to a Native American Indian friend of mine, and I asked him about how he felt his country had been, or his people had been depicted in American films. And he said, I suppose with a certain amount of resignation, he said, you know, it's not enough that our civilization was wiped out, but then we had to watch ourselves on film, on horseback, as savages throwing spears. So the desire to tell the truth about who you are and where you are in your history, I suppose, has always marked Irish film, although we were denied access to the means to do that.
Well, it was the terrible situation where many Irish people came here because of the potato famine, and then they wound up being discriminated against here as well.
Well, I think the Irish potato famine, which happened in 1845, was our Holocaust. 8 million people, the population went from 8 million people to 4 million people. And that event, that catastrophic event, didn't change just Irish politics, but it changed American politics forever.
My guest is Gabriel Byrne, Ireland's cultural ambassador and the curator of Revisiting the Quiet Man, Ireland on Film, which is running at MoMA from today through June 3rd as part of Imagine Ireland, Culture Ireland's Year of Irish Arts in America 2011. We have a full schedule posted on our show page at WNYC.org. And Mr. Byrne will be introducing the Quiet American tonight.
The Quiet Man
tonight at 7 p.m. So you'll also have some guests as well.
Yes, I'll have a professor of social studies who will put the film in the context of its role in American film and its influence on people like Spielberg and Scorsese and so forth, and look at it objectively as a product of a Hollywood of 1950, a Hollywood that when you think back on it, it's kind of interesting that the golden age of Hollywood, I suppose, was between 1934 and 1959. And during that time, there was a representative of the Vatican, of the Catholic Church, a man called Joe Breen, who vetted every single script that went through there. Between the Hayes office and Joe Breen, American films were highly censored, which resulted in sometimes a great deal of imaginative and creative solutions.
We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Gabriel Byrne, who is Ireland's cultural ambassador, the first ever?
Yes, the first ever. Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I think that there were certain people, although it's a non-governmental appointment, non-political appointment, there were certain people who felt that that culture and the arts were an intricate part of the revival of self-esteem as a country, because, as you know, economically we have been, essentially what happened there very briefly was 10 or 12 Bernie Madoffs took over the country.
Very recently. It was,
yes.
Ireland was going through this boom time.
Oh, God, yeah.
And maybe there were too many people who just thought it would go on forever.
Well, people did think it was going to go on forever, and you can't blame people if the banks are saying, yeah, there's no problem, we'll give you the money to buy an apartment in Uzbekistan. And so the people would pick things off the internet and say, yeah, I'll have one of those. I remember a friend of mine in Dublin saying to me one day that one Saturday morning, this is how mad at God, actually, one of his friends called up and said, listen, we're going to Berlin for lunch. Do you want to come? And he said, okay, I'll go to Berlin for lunch. So they go on the private plane to Berlin. They have lunch, and a guy says, "Oh, there's a block of flats for sale, you know, just down the road from the restaurant, and a block of pre-war flats." And they bought the block of flats, and were back in Dublin that evening for dinner. It's been a horrendously difficult time economically.
Well, that probably was a better investment than some. Berlin is still booming.
Berlin is booming. But it was the idea that there was no end to the amount of money that you could borrow. And there was a sense of, I suppose, greed on the part of certain people. But it devastated the country in terms of its self-esteem. The banking system collapsed, and then, of course, you had in tandem with that the collapse of the Catholic Church as well. So both the moral and the financial structures both collapsed almost at the same time. And so we're a country now in the process of regaining our self-esteem, trying to build our lives back together again. And at the forefront of that, I think, is a recognition that the world of the spirit and the world of the imagination and the world of arts are tremendously important, and that they feed the soul as opposed to, you know, tend to the more temporal things that the Celtic Tiger encouraged.
Well, in this city, I think that most people think of Ireland in terms of the culture, because we even have our own Irish Theatre Company. Right now we have Oscar Wilde on Broadway in a wonderful production. Martin McDonagh, anytime any play by him opens up,
yes,
you can almost predict it's going to be a big hit.
Yes.
And so our sense of Ireland these days has been rather cultural, and you've put together this thing called Imagine Ireland, which includes over 400 events going across all the art forms.
Yes. My sense about the arts is that it is a language that, as human beings, it's common to all of us. Art doesn't have boundaries. I think, as I said before, without being too pretentious about it, I think art feeds the spirit. And I think this campaign of Imagine Ireland is to bring knowledge and awareness of not just the people that you've talked about who are fantastic, like Druid and Martin McDonagh and Oscar Wilde and so forth, but there's a whole new generation of young Irish artists who are drawing on their own Irish background and ethnicity, but at the same time becoming universal artists.
Did you feel a connection to Eugene O'Neill when you appeared in A Moon for the Misbegotten and A Touch of the Poet, a person who was obviously very aware of his Irish roots and at the same time was very American, one of our greatest playwrights?
Yes. O'Neill's father, interestingly enough, was from a small village near where my father came from. And I had kind of grown up on the myth of O'Neill's father being the first great Broadway actor, a challenge to Edwin Booth.
Well, we see the other side of that story in Long Day's Journey and Tonight.
And Long Day's Journey and Tonight. I mean, O'Neill is fascinating because what he did was he took his family and basically he put his family on the stage and he was ruthless and merciless in exposing their weaknesses. Yes, I did identify with Eugene O'Neill, but what I identified with him, I think, was he was a playwright who never lied about anything. And his great ambition, he said, as a writer was, he said, it was a quote that I've always remembered. He said, "We are all haunted by the masks that we wear ourselves and the masks that others wear." And his ambition as a writer was to remove those masks and to see who are we really. And I suppose, going back to this exhibition of film, it's about looking at who we are and who we have been perceived to be through Irish film, because we gain so much knowledge about each other and oftentimes false knowledge of each other by the films that we see.
Well, you had to pick and choose, and I was curious about some of the selections. You have Jim Sheridan's In the Name of the Father, which is based on the autobiography of Jerry Conlon, mm-hmm. I gather Jim Sheridan will actually be introducing it,
yes,
on the 28th. But you don't have My Left Foot, which is very much about Irish home and identity.
Once again, it's impossible. It's like if somebody said, "Okay, put 20 books together that you love." I think that the themes of My Left Foot, which are about poverty, motherhood, the struggle of the artist, I think they're covered in other films.
Mm-hmm.
I think films like The Wind That Shakes the Barley. So a lot of Americans come to me and they say, what is the north of Ireland? What was going on there? Like people say about the Middle East, what is going on there? Like, tell me really what's going on. Those two films, I think, In the Name of the Father and The Wind That Shakes the Barley, when you come out of those films, you understand why that awful tragedy in the north of Ireland happened. And I think it marks a huge turning point for Irish film, because it was the first time that an Irish director made a film about Ireland and about Irish history.
Well, the films are being made in Ireland now, but mostly subsidized. Is it kind of like what you see in third world countries where money is put together from England and France and Germany and the United States?
Well, I think, unfortunately, you know, Ireland is no different to any other country when it comes to the huge kind of juggernaut of Hollywood films. A friend of mine who went for to meet one of the studio people was told by his agent, don't mention character and don't mention drama in the meeting. And he told me that with, he just couldn't believe that he'd been told to say that. But
so it would be all plot?
So, well, action. I think one of the things that's happened, say with the arrival of reality television, which was inevitable in a way, people have become more and more addicted to the notion of spectacle and sensation. The idea of the complex emotional build-up to a point being made, I think that kind of film has to fight for its survival. Huge franchise films are low-budget comedy films. The days of the in-between $15 and $20 million film may be over. And what I think is tremendously important for American audiences is that American audiences hear what people outside America are saying about their own culture. We don't know that terribly much about Iceland or Africa or India or whatever. But if you go to any of those countries, you'll see an American film. So the idea of subtitle films, which at one stage used to account for 13% of the viewing population, is now down to 0.1%. And that's bad for American audiences because it means that America becomes more culturally isolated.
Now, what happens when films from Hollywood about Ireland are shown in Ireland? Going back to The Quiet Man, did people resent it, or did they think it was all right? Did they find it as charming as Americans found it?
That's a very interesting question. There's an awful lot of Irish people who wanted The Quiet Man to be true, and there was an awful lot of Irish people who thought it was retrograde and brought everything back to the 19th century. But we were so unused to being depicted on film that I remember being in a cinema in Dublin, and a documentary came on about the city, and it showed one of the bridges of Dublin in its opening title, and it got a round of applause because we were so unused to
even being paid attention to.
We were just being paid attention to. But then in American films, you had the rise of the Irish-American character, people like James Cagney and, you know, the Pat O'Briens, the Bing Crosbys. There was a huge...
Barry Fitzgerald, Maureen O'Hara. A lot.
Quite a lot. And
and mostly treated with a lot of affection.
A lot of affection. But for some people, devoid of the complexity of what it meant to be Irish. And what we'll be looking at in these films is, you know, how were we perceived? How did Hollywood perceive Irish people? And it's a series that I hope will open up to other nationalities in other countries. Like, how is Mexico perceived in film? How is, you know, India, Africa, and so forth? Because, as I said before, we need to listen to each other's stories, and we need to be heard.
Well, we seem to be sending out mixed messages. On the one hand, we have a film that's being featured, John Huston's The Dead, with a screenplay by Tony Huston that's being shown on May 21st and 25th. And then we have another movie like Finian's Rainbow or Darby O'Gill and the Little People about leprechauns.
Yes, yes.
Both about – now, one is this very profound story, and the other is Ireland is this place where cute people and little elves live.
Interesting point. The Dead was John Huston's last film and his most personal film, and it's one of the most beautiful adaptations of a short story ever. Beautiful adaptation. I think a film like Darby O'Gill and The Little People is an example of how something that was essentially extremely serious. There was a time when people did not have the benefit of scientific explanation to explain the world around them. So it was explained in terms of the supernatural. And the supernatural was represented by fairies, by trolls, by bad spirits, and so forth. And so what happened was that in the 19th and 20th century, especially in theatre, that way of explaining the world, that very valid way of explaining the world and things that could not be comprehended. For example, I'll give you an example. A child who died of a wasting disease. The community didn't know how to comprehend that. So what they did was they invented the fairies would have been responsible for taking away the real child and replacing with a sickly child. okay, it may be primitive to look back on, but the basis of leprechauns, trolls, they're in every community and in every society. But what Disney did in 1957 with Darby O'Gill and the Little People was they Disneyfied that notion and made it funny and made it interesting, but once again added to the notion of, you know, the Irish has been a combination of... I think it's a very funny film, and I think it's extremely well done and very scary.
The reason I ask is because there are also trolls and and horrible things in Grimm's fairy tales and other cultures, but whenever we think about those cute things, we always think about Ireland.
Yes.
And perhaps that's been part... Maybe that's an affectionate part of the depiction of Ireland. So not everybody is an alcoholic. You know, there are also nice things, shamrocks.
All of
those songs.
For example,
Mother.
We are a nation of great musicians and singers, and we sang our history, really. And that idea of the shamrock is an old pagan idea that explains the three phases, the three personalities of the moon. So when you go back and you examine what's behind these kind of affectionate images, you find that they have a real basis and a real root in folk tradition.
Now, how does this apply to you? You strike me as a fairly happy sort, but what do you make of the fact that so many people have described you as brooding?
I don't know. Maybe it's just the way my features fall.
If you're going to play shrinks, troubled shrinks, maybe they'll start associating you with that.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think he was a tortured kind of man, and I tend to be drawn towards playing tortured kind of people because I think they're more interesting. There's more layers and more levels and complexities. And I don't believe, you know, in the notion of a constant state of happiness. I believe that we all struggle with our good days, bad days, and grey days. And it's the grey days that interest me more as a... as an actor. Of course, I'd love to be one of those people permanently happy, but I don't know really anybody who is.
One of the films you chose, you did appear in, Jim Sheridan's Into the West. But your next film will be directed by Neil LaBute. He's going to look for the brooding side, isn't he?
Well, it's actually an Agatha Christie film. So
Crooked House by...
Crooked House by Agatha Christie. And... I'm sure, like me, you love all those kind of talk about being stereotyped, that English country house with all those kind of crazy, dysfunctional, upper crust, mad aristocratic English people. So I'm going to play one of those for a change.
Didn't you come to acting rather late?
Yeah, I didn't become an actor till I was 28, 30 years old. I was a teacher before that. I taught Gaelic literature, English literature and Spanish. And
had you wanted to act?
No, not at all. I used to take my kids, my classes, to the films and to the theatre because I thought it was a great way of opening up discussions with them. And when you met them outside the classroom and you had a film to talk about, you got to see sides of them that you never got to see when you say, what's the present tense of the verb, you know, to be. And so one of them said one day, you know, we'd love to have a drama class. And I knew nothing about it whatsoever. And so I went to the headmistress and she said, well, yes, but you'd have to have it outside class. So we met outside class and at weekends. And I have to say that it was one of the most enjoyable times of my life. And it taught me that, because to be honest, as a teacher, I was a little bit intimidated by my students. I was 22. I was teaching girls who were 18 and 19 and who had no mercy on me whatsoever. They were absolutely ruthless in their collective behavior towards me. Individually, it was easy to sort them out, but...
My imagination is running rampant here.
It was, well, then we did a co-production with the boys' school and we put on this play and Jim Sheridan actually came to see the play and he said, you know, you were pretty good up there because I had to play one of the characters because one of the kids got sick. A bit like that woman who was discovered in the chemist shop. What's her name?
Lana Turner.
Lana Turner. It was a bit of a Lana Turner story.
Except that you were acting, so... we originally had booked you for next week, but then didn't President Obama call?
Yeah, I'm going to Dublin on the 23rd to introduce President Obama. They're closing off our main street, O'Connell Street there, and of course Obama coming to Ireland will be the same thing as Kennedy coming to Ireland, because it's we love to keep that contact between America and Ireland. We've had Reagan, we've had Clinton, we've had, who was the other one? We had Nixon, got an egg thrown at his car while he was there. And we've had them all there, except that guy who got in for 8 years.
Well, we thank you for coming here, Gabriel Byrne, Ireland's cultural ambassador, curator of Revisiting the Quiet Man, Ireland on Film, which is running at the Museum of Modern Art from today until June 3rd. And tonight at 7, Mr. Byrne will be engaged in a discussion with some other special guests before the screening. This is all part of Imagine Ireland, Culture Ireland's Year of Irish Arts in America 2011. And for a full schedule of the series, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Leonard. And can I just finish by saying one thing, which I really mean? I think that independent radio and radio itself is so tremendously important. It was the thing that brought me to drama. It was the thing that brought me to the world of imagination. When you watch television, you're a passive kind of participant or non-participant. When you listen to radio, your imagination is involved. And public independent radio is crucial to debate and the expansion of ideas and imagination. And I'm going to sign up for $180 for the cookery book.
Oh, yeah. Well, Julia Child, you can't go wrong.
Okay, I can't go wrong with that.
And thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for those final words as well.
Thank you, Leonard.